I guess it was in about 2006. I was contacted by Dr. Stephen Austin about a new project that was going to be sponsored by ICR. It's due for creation research, and was asked if I wanted to, participate and in a initial, working meeting, and to see how that would work out. Now, the interesting thing about this was a geology project. This is different than the RATE project, which is more of a physics and type of project. Geologists like to meet in areas in which they can go on geological field trips. And so our first meeting was in St. George, Utah. And I remember the first meeting, we went and saw some dinosaur tracks, and they had us climbing up all kinds of stuff and showing us things, and that was really very interesting. We're getting together for the first time, and we, after that meeting, was decided to divide the project into three parts. And the three parts were, since it was FAST stands for, I didn't put it up here, but we said it enough, I think, flood activated sedimentation and tectonics. Now, only a geologist would come up with a name like that. And the idea was what they wanted to study was the mechanisms that could explain how the sediment was taken from one place and transported to another, all the various different processes, and then how it was lithified, turned into stone, and then also the tectonics, that's the earthquakes, all the seismic activity that could move mountains and actually cause the birth of mountains. At the same time, I was told that they wanted to build all of their geological and geophysics research on an accurate understanding of the text of Genesis. So they wanted to have a Hebraist in on the project, and I guess I was elected for that. And so the FAST project is divided into three divisions. It has the sedimentation division. It has the orogenesis division, which is a tectonics division. And then it has what's called the flood narrative division. And I'm in the flood narrative division. And I came up with this initial title for my particular project in that division. And it's very typical of kind of a scholarly article or something like that. Linguistic and literary characteristics of Genesis 5:20 to 9:29, implications for the chronology of the flood. That's what my project is. And what I'm trying to do is exactly what it says up here. I'm trying to establish the chronology of the flood. And by that, I mean the very precise chronology in terms of how long, well, I'll show you what I'm talking about here, the various different questions. First of all, when did the flood begin? And that is really something that probably I cannot answer in terms of the chronology. That's more for the geologist. Although we can look at the genealogies and so forth, but that's not really my purpose. But that obviously is an issue that must be addressed probably later down the road. The beginning of the flood. And then more interest to the geologist is when did the fountain stop up? In Genesis, we're told that the fountains of the great deep that they opened up, and that the windows of heaven opened, and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, there are different scenarios, different ideas about when the fountains closed up. Some say 40 days, some say 150, some even say 190. There's different understandings of that. That's very important for the geologist because of the geological processes, particularly if the geological processes were sped up because of the of what the rate work has indicated. So this is very important that whether it's 40 days or 150 or 190 days. And I'll explain this a little bit more in a second. So, and then how long did the waters rise? Which is basically it's a question that is coupled with that second question. If the fountains stopped up 40 days or 150 days, how long did the waters rise for 110 days until you get to 150? Did they rise for 150 days? Did they rise only for 40 days? Okay. There's various different understandings of that. And then how long did the water recede? Waters recede. Those are the questions that initially I had, and I thought that these were very important questions to answer in order to have a pretty solid basis for understanding the chronology of the flood. Now, when I've taught the flood for many years. I usually teach Old Testament survey twice a year. And so I've been teaching for 10 years at the Master's College. I've taught even before that for 2 years, about the same number of times. So I've taught about 24, 25 times. I've taught Old Testament Survey 1. And I've always taught that the center of the flood, I had always taught before I started doing my research, that the center of the flood is in Genesis 8:1. Let's take a look at that text. Now you can see I'm working on the tabernacle, but we're going to go to Genesis. The students at the college can hardly believe that I study anything else other than Genesis, but I really do. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. And I was of the opinion that the center of the flood was represented by this verse. Okay, the reason for that has to do with a particular structure of the numbers that are used in the Genesis flood account. If I can go back to my PowerPoint here, I think I want this one. Yeah, this will work perfectly. Okay, now if we go back from here. Okay. There is a grouping of numbers. I'll move over here. There's a grouping of numbers, and I've tried to indicate that by the different colors. I love colors. Okay, that's what I really love doing the tabernacle, because all the colors there. But you can see the number. You find a number 7, and then the number 40. And if we keep on going, let's go to the next one. And then here we have 150, 150, and then it's going to say the next one is going to be 40. Okay, 40. Whoops, 40. And then lastly, there's a 7, and I can't find it offhand. There's 7 right there. And so we have, you see what we have? We have 7, 40, 150, 150, 40, 7. That's what we call a chiastic structure. And right in the middle of that is Genesis 8:1. And so the text is focusing on that verse. There's no question about that. And I always thought, well, that has to be the middle of the flood, okay? Because that's the middle of the text. That's clearly where the theological focus is. But as I began to study this text, and what we have here are in the light blue, whoops, don't want to spoil that yet. In the light blue, there are, in the text of the flood account, there are 5 fixed dates that are given. 5 fixed dates that depend upon the life of Noah. I had never noticed this before. I mean, I noticed there were 5, there were dates, but I never really, when you really dig into something, you start to see things you haven't seen before. Well, the first fixed date is the beginning of the flood, okay? So in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were open. The rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Okay? In the selfsame day, or on that very day, entered Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth and so forth into the ark. All right? So that's the first fixed date, the beginning of the flood. Let's look at the next fixed date. And they're all in terms of the life of Noah. These occurred in his 600th year. Okay? Here's the next one. The next one is when the ark runs aground. Okay, this is very important, and this is what really threw me. Okay? On the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, that's when the ark rested, when it ran aground. Okay? Now, you figure this out. Seventh month, 17th day of the month. If you reckon, as the ancients did, months had 30 days, then the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, is how many days after the second month, the 17th day of the month? It's 5 times 30. It's 150. Okay? So 150 days. All right? Now, I looked at that, and I said, that's interesting. Well, let's go to the next, the third fixed date. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, what happened to it? Messed it up. That is when the mountaintops appeared. The mountaintops appeared. That was that's the third fixed date. Then the fourth fixed date is in the 600th first year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from off the earth, and Noah removed the covering. Okay? That's the fourth fixed date. And then the last fixed date is the 7th and 20th day of the month of that 601st year of Noah's life. The ark, the flood is over. Okay? It's over. Now, with that in mind, let me go back now to the possible chronological scenarios that could obtain in this situation. Chronological scenarios, we love these acronyms in ICR. ICR itself is an acronym. All these people have acronyms. We're talking about the LFS versus the SFS, okay? And then there's the ELFS as well, which we don't have here. But that's the extra long. So the long flood scenario, the LFS, that is 150 days, followed by a relatively short abatement of 221 days. I mean, by the abatement, I mean that when the waters are receding. And then the short flood scenario, 40 days, followed by 331-day abatement. All right, now, we can picture this in this way. Actually, we can. Let me see. I thought I had it. That must be the other one. Just a second. Hang on there. I guess it's in this one. Now, for some reason, I know why. It's not in PowerPoint. Okay, now we can do it. Because I want you to see these two scenarios. These are the fixed dates now. You can see them. And here we have the long flood scenario. The 40, that's the 40 days of rain and 40 and 40 day, 40 nights and 40 days and 40 nights of rain. The 150 is the day in which the ark runs aground. The 220, 224, that is when the mountaintops appear. And then we have the other dates. This is when Noah removed the cover, and the end of the ark is around 370 or 371. Okay, so this is what it looks like. There's the ark. There's the water going down, and so this is the kind of the profile of the long flood scenario. The reason why we have this mountain over here is it says the mountain tops appeared. That's plural. So we have to have more than just Ararat appearing, but other mountains. And so that's what it looks like. A lot of people have this view. This is the, clearly the view of the Genesis flood. You know, by Whitcomb and Morris, have this view. The other view is called the short flood scenario, which has a long abatement of 331 days. That looks like this. The waters rise for 40 days, okay? And then we have a long period of abatement, and so it looks like this in profile once we're finished this part. Looks like that. Now you can see a couple of results of that. We have a much deeper flood for one thing, because it goes up and then it's on the way down. Now I have talked to people about this, and it's most logical that a boat is going to run aground when the water is receding rather than when the water is rising. Essentially, this has got a problem, and not only in the Hebrew grammar, which I'll talk about in a moment, but logically, this doesn't make sense, that you would run aground, particularly when it says that the water was 22 and a half feet above the mountaintops. Why would you run aground when the water is rising? It makes a lot more sense that the ark ran aground when the water was decreasing. Now this is a flood. This is the scenario that the short flood scenario. There's another one I didn't put in there, the extra long flood scenario, in which we have 190 days of rising. That makes the least sense of all, because then you're definitely way up on the rise and you're running aground. It would float it again. And it doesn't say that, so that doesn't seem to be as tenable a view, although there's some to hold that view. And so here we have the short flood scenario with the long abatement. I am fairly convinced that this is right, okay, logically, and as I start looking at the Hebrew. Now, I'm not going to go into all the detail. It's just too complicated. But there... What happens is this view asserts that the verb forms always indicate sequential action, okay? But then we have, these are the sequences of verb forms. There's nine of them, okay? This is right out of the text. The waters prevailed upon the earth for 150 days. God remembered Noah. God caused the wind. The waters subsided, began to subside. The fountains of the deep closed. The rain from heaven was restrained. The water returned continually from off of the earth. The water lacked at the end of 150 days, and then the ark came to rest. Okay? And this all was on the 150th day, according to this theory. This idea, you have a real problem here. If these things are sequential, if this happened after this, and this happened after this, and this happened after this, which by the way, is this kind of the standard way of looking at this particular verb form, vayiktol. So in my research, I'm challenging the standard grammatical understanding of the vayiktol form as being indicating sequential action. And I'm working with a graduate student on this, and we are coming up with examples where, in fact, even in the tabernacle, I've seen examples where these are not sequential. And that is essentially what it is. So the idea that the waters prevailed upon the earth for 150 days, and then God remembered Noah, then God caused the wind, this is what you have to have in order to have this type of a flood, this kind of a situation at 150 days. And that, in my opinion, is really problematic. Mainly because some of these things definitely indicate process. God caused the wind to blow over the earth, and then you get an idea. The waters subsided or began to subside. We have processes here. Now, there's room for the processes if we stop at, you know, at 40 days. And what warrant is there in the text to say that the rain continued after 40 days? Those who say that the water continues to rise, on what basis does the water arise? Does the water continue to rise? If the rain is shut off, okay, after 40 days, rain for 40 days and 40 nights, if the rain was shut off and the fountains of the deep were closed, then what sources of water are there that could make it rise? Well, some of the geologists say, well, yeah, maybe something could have dropped down or something like that. You know, I guess that's possible. They actually don't like this. They don't like my idea that it's the 40 and 331, because there's issues in regard to dinosaur tracks. We have dinosaur tracks in certain levels, and they say, well, these dinosaur tracks were made, you know, in mud. This is not underwater tracks. How do you explain this? And these are things that we have to work through, some of these issues. But it's really interesting to work with these guys. These guys are these brilliant geologists and paleontologists. They're a different group from the Rake group. They're a different group of people and have very different interests. And it's very interesting to work with about 17 of us working on this project. So we assembled again a second time. We assembled in St. George, Utah. And then our last meeting was at Grand Canyon. We went to Kingman, Arizona. We assembled at Kingman, Arizona, made an arrangement with the Hualapai Indians to drive down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And there's only one road. It goes through the Indian Territory. I had my brand new Chrysler Aspen. I drove down that road. It got down to the bottom. It was all covered with mud and dirt, and the geologist said, "Now it's a geologist's truck," you know. So, but that was the issue. So we have these processes that we have to deal with, and that's what I've been trying to argue. I've been saying these processes. Now, let me show you one of the things that we have already solved one of the problems. See, there's the 150 and 50 and so forth. Okay. Now, these are my objectives. Don't worry about those. They're my research objectives. These are the grammatical issues for objective one. What is the basis for determining the chronology? So this is technical stuff. The eightfold occurrence of vaihi. Vaihi is a particular verb form that occurs eight times in this text. It's very important that we understand it. I'll talk to you about the alternative translations here. The order of the events depicted by the sequential vaihi told, and we have a particular verbal form called double infinitive absolutes. And I'll show you what I'm talking about. Let's go to the text again. And the issue is right here. This is translated, and the water receded steadily from the earth. Now, which one do I have here? This is the New American Standard. And you will see different translations understand this differently. Let's try the KJV. And the waters returned from off the earth continually. Okay, that seems good. Let's try the Tanakh. They'll probably have continually as well. The waters then receded steadily from the earth. The grammatical issue is this. We have, it turns out, two different verbal forms. And I can show it to you. And this is a colorized text that I provided for the geologists who don't know Hebrew. And so I told them, I said, well, we've got these different things here. The issue is this thing in gray right here. These are infinitive absolute forms, and this is the verb for halach, means to go, okay? To go, to move. And this is to return. There are some who understand these two infinitive absolutes as going and returning, which suggests to the geologists a type of oscillatory motion of the water going back and forth and back and forth. So the first thing we wanted to do was to determine whether it was back and forth, which would mean, you know, in other words, going out and then coming back, or is this the idiomatic usage of halach, which means to do something continually? And so the idea of returning continually or steadily. So I had my graduate student, Lainey Stroop, do an analysis of the 57 infinitive, double infinitive absolutes that occur. And I suggested to him how, you know, how to do this analysis. And he found certain patterns. And when the pattern was a certain way, it was the lexical usage of halach. When it was another way, then it was the idiomatic usage. And he found that this was an example of the idiomatic usage, which means that this is referring to a continual receding. So the waters return from off the earth continually is the best way of understanding this. Now that's a major, that's already a hurdle we've jumped over in our research, because that's an important issue to to nail down whether this is oscillatory action or not. As I said, it's really different geologically whether you have this mass of water going back and forth like this, or if it's steadily receding. And what can receding water do? I had no idea. I guess it was our first fast meeting in St. George, Utah. And Interstate 15 goes through St. George, and the geologists are saying there is this formation called an anticline. Now, what an anticline is, it means you have layers going up in this direction and then layers going up in this direction, and it forms a bow like this. And so they're telling me there's an anticline here, and I'm there. But, there's Route 15 in the middle. There's no anti, there's nothing. And they said, well, you can see the layers going up about 100 yards from Interstate 15 on this side. They're going up this way. And about another 100 or 200 yards on the other side, they're going up like that. And I said, well, what happened to the stuff in the middle? And they said, well, the flood deposited those layers that you see, and then the receding waters ripped out what had been deposited. That's the power of this water receding. It just can pull all of these layers out. Now you can imagine what it would have been like if it was going, instead of just a continual receding, which would mean that it's not only is it taking those layers out, but it's going to deposit all that stuff at the end, when the water slows down enough, it's going to deposit it. But if it's sloshing back and forth like this, that's going to create a very different geological landscape than the other scenario. So I think it was very important that we have established. Now some people are disagreeing with this. They don't like these conclusions, but I think they're pretty solid. I think they're pretty solid. Okay, now, what else are we concerned with here? As I said, we're concerned with, let's take a look at the top here of the beginning of the flood. This is an important issue for our research and for chronology. Starts with verse 17. Okay. Yeah, Hugh was saying to me, when are you going to start using the colorized Hebrew text? I said, well, I don't really want to do that. But for this, I have to. I'm sorry. This blue-green color, that's the word for flood, Mabul. Mabul. In fact, one of the geologists, he liked that word so much, he changed his email address to mabul.com or something like that. It's really funny. But he liked that. It's the word Mabul. It occurs only in the flood account. And then it is used as a time marker in Genesis 10 and in Genesis 11, 2 years after the flood. Now, it was such a momentous, gigantic event that people dated things by the flood. Well, it only occurs here, Mabul. as I said, it's the word for this incredible catastrophe that we call Noah's flood. It's from a Hebrew word which means to carry everything. And so it's that which carries everything away is the idea of the word. It does occur one other place. It occurs in Psalm 29, verse 10, in which is talking about God's power, that he sat enthroned upon the flood. In other words, he was king reigning over the flood. He was in control of the whole thing. Now, the issue here in terms of the chronology has to do with a way in which this is translated. Here we have that form vayhi, okay? Different ways this could be translated are this. This could be translated as a temporal clause. When the flood was 40 days upon the earth, the water multiplied. Now, that would be that the water had to go up for 40 days before the water was enough to then lift up the ark, okay? That's one possible scenario. And that is kind of an older understanding of this, that you have the flood is increasing, and then the ark, then it lifted up the ark, and the ark rose above the earth, and so forth. And by the way, theologically, this passage is an uncreation. I know it's not a word, but I'm just coining that term. It's an uncreation of the world. God is returning the earth into the featureless water ball that it was to start with, that he started with. Remember in Genesis 1-2, what it was like? He returned it to that. And the language at the end of the flood, that the mountaintops appeared, is exactly the same as the language that the dry land appeared. So, and also there's also a recapitulation of the divine blessing, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. So it's clearly an uncreation of the world and then a recreation of the world after the flood. And so that's the theology of it. And clearly the center of it, as I said, the center of the text is Genesis. No question, it's Genesis 8:1. But the geologists I don't want to say they're not interested in the theology. Of course they are. They're Christians, but they want to know about the chronology of what happened. So if the flood was a multiplying and the waters were multiplying and then it lifted up, that would be one idea. Another way of translating with this would be to say what this is doing is giving us an initial encapsulation of the whole time, okay? The flood was on the earth for 40 days. That's what I think this is. I think this is an encapsulation. And then what follows is a description of what the flood was like, both geologically and hydrologically, and then also what it did to all the life, okay? And then these should not be necessarily understood in terms of temporal sequence, this happening after this, but simultaneity. And so one of the issues that's going on here, and I've had to do a lot of research in linguistics literature on this, is how do you determine when actions are sequential, when this follows this? Well, the linguists have pretty much decided that the way you determine that is if this action ends, what we call telicity, when that action ends. Well, the problem with this text is these are not actions. These are states. Okay? There was a lot of water. That's what it's saying. The water was multiplying. That's not an action. That's a state. Now, this is action, that water lifted up the ark. But a lot of these verbs, like this verb down here, gavar, that means to be strong, to prevail. And so that is another state of verb. It's pretty hard to determine sequentiality when you have state of verbs. And so, I'm going to be arguing, this is in November, that we have a text in which is going to be very difficult to establish sequentiality, which is necessary to do if you're going to say that all those things happened one after another and in order to get the 150-day, the long flood scenario. And so, but what this says, and it's very clear, is the water multiplied and lifted up and lifted up the ark, rather than then. Because as it's multiplying, okay, as the water is increasing, what's happening is the ark is lifting, because the buoyancy factor. It's not happening afterwards, it's happening at the same time. But because of language, you can't put this verb, in a sense, over this one. It has to follow in line, but the action is happening at the same time. See what I'm saying? And so the water is multiplying and lifting up the ark, and then you know, so the ark is rising upon above the surface, above the earth. The water multiplied, gosh, was strong. Now it says, and it was multiplying exceedingly upon the earth, and the ark was going upon. Now this is very interesting. Nothing really to do with the sequentiality, but with the flood. Here it's talking about its relationship to the earth. It's above the earth. Now it's talking about its relationship to the water. There's no longer an earth to even, you know, a ground to have any point of reference. It's on the surface of the water it's dealing with. That's what it's talking about, the surface of the water. And so the ark is traveling on the surface of the water, and the waters were very, very strong upon the earth. Now, this does seem to be a sequence of you know, kind of states, very strong, very strong, very, very strong. But there is no conclusion of one state. It's just moving to getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So it's very difficult to in that way to determine sequentiality. And at the and then the description is given to really show what it's like. All the mountains were covered. All the high mountains, which were under all of heaven. One of the issues that's come up with this study, and one of the other guys is working on, is to answer the question: was this a universal flood? Now, as Christians, and believing the Bible, we believe it's a universal flood. But there are other Christians who say, no, this is not a universal flood. This was a local flood. And so, one of the things you can do very, very simply is to notice all the occurrences of all. In the flood account, all the alls in there. I remember when I was presenting this thing, Dr. Fouts was over there, and you know, when he had, I'd given a colored version of this to everybody, and he was over there busily writing, and I was thinking, what is he doing? And what he was doing is he was just simply adding up all of the alls in the text. And one of the geologists said, well, how do we know it's really all? I mean, you know, and so he says, well, it occurs like 22 times the word all. I mean, if the Lord wanted it to be, he certainly seems to be communicating to us that it's all. The arguments are given, well, you know, all doesn't always mean all. And the standard argument is, and I don't know how you react to this, but the standard argument is when it says, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Does that mean every person has sinned? Every man has sinned? No, there's one person that didn't sin, Jesus. Okay, so you could say, well, that's all, that all means all minus one. And so the argument is given that, well, maybe then these alls are not universal either. You see? But when you have, that's just one all in Romans 3:23 there. There are a lot of alls in this section. And the way it's described, particularly that you have the ark floating above all these mountaintops, all the high mountains, and the when you look also at the geological record and you see these 10,000 feet of sediment, this is not a local phenomenon. And so it's a, it's quite a thing. So, and all the mountains were covered. And then this is, it says 15 cubits, okay, 15 cubits and upwards, the waters were strong. Let me move ahead here. Okay? We're strong, and the mountains were covered. Now, that's the description of the kind of the geology and the hydrology of what's going on with the water. What's happening with life? Because God's purpose for bringing the flood, if we go back into chapter 6, we don't have time for that, but we can see, is that man had corrupted himself on the earth to the extent that it uses the language that the pain had reached to heaven. It's the same word that's used. The pain is the same word that's used for the pain that that Eve would experience in childbirth, that Adam would experience in toiling, you know, to produce a crop. It is what Lamech says when he prays about his new son Noah. May he give us relief from all the pain, from all the pain from the land which God has cursed. Well, it was God's purpose to destroy all life except Noah and his family. And so we have here this description. And again, all flesh which moves upon the earth, okay, expired. That's a pretty strong language. Among the birds. Now, oaf, Hebrew, anything that flies, whether it's a bird or an insect. I remember in my Hebrew class, a bee flew in, and one of my students was actually a he's with Friends of Israel. He is a Jewish believer. He learned Hebrew. I mean, he's in his 70s. He was in my Hebrew class the same time his grandson was. This bee flew in, and Marty says, "An oaf." And because that's what an oaf is, anything that flies, whether it's a bee or it's a bird. So here we have this flying thing, so all the flying things, and behemah, that's the domestic animals, the wild animals, and all the swarming things which swarm upon the earth, and all of mankind expired. Okay? Now, if that's not strong enough, look at the next statement. This is where the Hebrew can answer the questions that people have about the flood, or anything else for that matter. Everything in which there was the breath of life in his nostrils. Remember, God breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of man? The same word is used. Actually, it's the breath of the spirit of life in his nostrils. Everything from which was on the dry land, died. So it says expired. It also uses the word died. And it uses the word all. Then if that's not strong enough, then it uses another word, macha, which means to wipe out, to blot out. Okay? And it blotted out, referring to the flood. And it blotted out. Now this is a unique word, hayakum. It means all existence. Okay? All existence, which was on the surface of the earth, from man and domestic animal until creeping thing, moving thing, and birds, okay, oaf of the heavens, right, and they were wiped out from the earth, okay, only Noah and those who were with him in the ark were left, survived. And then it says the water was strong upon the earth for 150 days. So all of this, the question that geologists are asking, and I haven't completely answered it yet, the question is, when did all the life die? Was it in the first 40 days? Was it the first 150 days? Because they have these dinosaur tracks. Dinosaur tracks are made by living dinosaurs. Okay, these are not made by dead dinosaurs. So when did the animals die? That's one of the questions we are asking. Now, we move on a little bit further. And here we have the famous verse. The Lord remembered Noah. Now, and the Lord remembered Noah. Did this happen after the 150 days? Or, since Noah and those who were with him in the ark survived, survived, was God remembering Noah all along. And so what this is giving us here is a contrast to what we've seen above here. All life, all other life dying, but Noah surviving. It's the latter, where it's a contrast. God remembered Noah and all the life and all the animals which were with him on the ark. And so, then that would mean that God caused a wind to go upon the earth, and the water, this is also a rather unique word, began to abate. That's what seems to be going on here. And the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven stopped up, and the rain also stopped. But we know when that was. We know that that was 40 days and 40 nights of rain. Those who take 150 days of rising waters have to postulate that it continued to rain, but not at the same rate. It was just kind of a gentle rain instead of this deluge. But there's no evidence in the text for that, okay? No evidence for the text on that. And then we have this. So, Yeshuva Hamayim Ha'aretz, and the waters return from off of the earth gradually, I think, or steadily. And so this is the picture we have. And then we have one of the five fixed dates coming up. Okay? And the water, and the ark. Oh, excuse me. First of all here, the water, this verb here, chasar, means to lack. When used with liquids, there's only a couple places where it's used with liquids here. It's also used in the case of the cruse of oil with Elijah, and I think again also with Elisha, the same thing. It says it never lacked, where the level never went down. Well, here it's saying it lacked, which means it did go down. So the water was decreasing at the end of 150 days. Now, I looked at that, and I thought, now just consider this logically. If it was decreased at the end of 150 days, what does that mean? Was that mean the water was on the way up? Or that it had come down from a higher level? I mean, just use your inner head. It just seems to me that this is referring to the fact that the water had to have been deeper earlier, and the only way that you can have that is with that short flood scenario. Anyway, so then we have the statement, and the ark came to rest on the seventh. Okay, this is on the seventh, in the 27th. The seventh month, on the 27th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat, okay? It doesn't say on Mount Ararat, but on the mountains. It's somewhere in that region that it came to rest. And the water was continually receding or lacking until the 10th month. And then we have on this one, again, a five fixed date that the mountaintops appeared. So we have these five fixed dates that I'm building the chronology on, and the FND, that's the Flood Narrative Division. Remember an acronym, as we love those things. A Flood Narrative Division, FND of FAST, okay, which is all part of ICR. We are working on these chronological issues. I'm not going to go into the extremely technical issues that I'm going into, but we're looking at the linguistic research and all kinds of things in order to try to understand. Basically, what I'm trying to do is look at all the verbs that occur, all these vayik tol forms, anything which has this vav and a patach and a dagesh there, anything that looks like that, all the verbs look like that. Anytime that they occur in sequence, I want to see what changes going from verb to verb. And under what circumstances can we clearly say that the verbs are not in sequence. And we have some examples of that just in the tabernacle narrative. It says when Moses went up to the mountain And then it says Moses went up to the mountain. Moses went up to the mountain, and it's clear that the first time it's encapsulating, and then it goes and gives us the details. Well, that's the way we speak anyway. That's the way we talk. We say, you know, I went on a trip, okay? Not and then this happened, but and this these are the things that happen. And so that's what we find here with the flood. I think that's what it is. And so it turns out there's about 2,000 occurrences of the sequential viatoles. And what we're going to do is we're studying those to determine under what circumstances can we, you know, does it allow for us to have what's called the verbs are non-iconic, which means the verbs are not in the same order as the events. Now, in Genesis 1:1 through 2:3, we have viatole forms too, but also we have the sequence of days: the first day, the second day, the third day. So we have a framework to put the viatoles in. We do have a framework here: the five fixed dates, and any work that we do, any work that's done, must take into consideration those five fixed dates, particularly the fact that the ark ran aground on the 150th day. Well, I'm not at liberty to say anything about the other projects. The gag is on me on that. But I wonder if anybody has any questions about my research and what we went over and the FAST project in general. Anybody have any questions? People, yes. Could dinosaurs have lived after the flood? Oh, yes. They would have been taken aboard the ark because they're an animal, so they would have been taken aboard the ark. Now, Noah had some brains, we assume, and he would have taken small ones, small ones on board the ark, not big ones. So maybe dinosaur eggs, we don't know. But there's definitely, matter of fact, there's some who say that there are still dinosaurs in remote areas that there have been sightings and so forth. I don't know about that. But the paleontologists, they're hard to convince about this 40-day flood because they say, well, we've got these, matter of fact, I've seen the dinosaur tracks myself. We went out and saw them. We saw them last November. We were climbing up a place called, Chino Point. And we were in the Coconino Sandstone and climbed up Jan found some little dinosaur tracks, some little ones. And if you see those things, you know they were made under a certain circumstance and in mud. That indicates there's water there. Now, that's pretty interesting since the Coconino Sandstone is on top of the Grand Canyon. This is on top, which is at 7,000, the top of the Grand Canyon is over 7,000 feet. And so you've got dinosaur tracks in there, and they're in mud, okay, in sandstone. How do you explain that? I mean, it means you had to have a lot of water up there to do that. But still, that shows that there was water, but we need to know the sequence. They want to know when the animals died because of those types of situations. So hopefully the chronology is going to nail that down. Any other questions? Yes.
Were the tops of the mountains, when they appeared, were they there before the mountains of the Great Deep were opened up? Or did that cataclysm grow to them?
We don't know. All we can, that's one of the issues that another one of the groups is working on, orogenesis. And the question that he's asking is, were the mountains produced by the, were they already there and simply inundated by the flood, or were they produced? Depending upon the mechanisms that produce the water, one of the possible scenarios, and I'm not at liberty to go into great detail, but one of the possible scenarios that has been suggested would have produced tidal waves 1,000 feet high, tsunamis 1,000 feet high that would be sweeping across the land. That would effectively knock anything down and level off everything. with the violence of that, and constant. They would have been constant. So don't picture the flood as this water coming down, kind of like the bathtub model. The water comes down, and and then the bathtub fills up. That doesn't seem to be what the geologists and geophysicists are saying. They're saying there was unbelievable geological turmoil that was going on. Edges of continents dropping into the ocean floor dropping into the mantle. I mean, this is amazing stuff. Steam jets coming out of the ocean supersonically and then condensing as global rain. The surface of the Earth, like putting the surface of the Earth in a washing machine, okay? And then you have the depositing, and they're working on these phenomena, how the mud was deposited, all these different things. That's what the geologists are working on that. But I'm amazed at the theories that are, and I can't go into more detail about it, but the all their ideas for how the flood started. And an important issue, I'm glad you asked this question, because an important issue is the meaning of that phrase. The meaning of the phrase, that the fountains of the great deep split open and the windows of heaven open. If that is narrative, okay, if that's prose, that really limits the type of geological processes that could be described that way, okay? And so you get the ideas of their water plates under the earth, and that there are these huge sources of water. But if that is a little poetic couplet, which most Hebraists think that it is, okay, then that gives a lot more latitude to the geological processes that could have been described that way. Even to very violent upheavals, the continents being ripped open and so forth. I mean, it's very clear. Look at the globe. You can see all the continents fit together. Okay, you can see that. So one scenario is that they were all together. Okay, they were ripped apart, then they were slammed back together again, and then ripped apart again. Now, when you're talking about that, I mean, that's going to really change the surface of the Earth. And the geophysicist that is developing these theories, he's doing it all with computer modeling. He's one of the best computer modelers in the world, and has done it with computers over in Japan that can do 4 trillion calculations in 4 seconds. And so he was able to do all these calculations, modeling the surface of the Earth. Incredible. With these, and then he runs these like a film loop showing what this will do to the Earth's surface. It's incredible. And the amazing thing about it is it completely takes the surface of the Earth, all of the surfaces of the oceans, ocean floors, replaces them all with new surfaces, and then the process runs and it runs out, and it becomes stable again. It destabilizes unbelievably, and then it stabilizes into our current situation. So it looks like it's the right answer. I mean, I'm not going to go into all that, and I'm not at liberty to, but the reason why kind of the gag is on is because we want to have peer review of our research before we have it, you know, kind of in a popular form. One of the things that has happened with creation research in the past, not with RAID, but with other things, is that it became popularized, and then that immediately makes the scholarly community very, very leery, and they question the value and the validity of the research. So that's what's going on. Any other questions? Yes.
What's the most interesting question that has occurred to you that you can talk about?
The most interesting question to me is the sequentiality of the Vayik toll forms. In other words, and I think it could be something that is important for Hebrew research in general, in terms of how we understand the events, the sequence of events in biblical Hebrew, that we probably shouldn't be thinking of those as sequential just because of the verb form, but we have to determine sequentiality from something else. And we need to be aware of what the linguists are saying, take it seriously, consider it, you know, and that we need to be looking at the issue of telicity, whether an event has concluded before we can say that the next event is sequential with it. So that, I think that is very interesting, and will be an important thing. Another really important thing to me, I don't know whether we're going to get a chance to do it or not, but that will be to extend my rate research by developing a model which where we can use a much smaller sampling of verbs and even determine, like, for instance, in that verse I was telling you about, the fountains of the deep splitting open. My model with rate requires at least 30 verbs, which is what you have in a passage. But all you have is just a verse. How do you determine if that's narrative or poetry? This idea I have, I think, would do that, because it's based upon clause length and it's based upon a different thing. So that might be able to be some area of research, I think. Again, that would be an important tool for Hebrew studies. Yes. We did have an ice age. The ice age follows the flood, and as I understand it, it caused the flood. Excuse me, it caused the ice age. The flood caused the ice age. I misspoke. The flood caused the ice age. It has to do with an ice age occurs when you cannot get enough melting compensate for the snow. And there have been some nice books written on this. This is not my specialty. The guys at ICR who have worked on this is Larry Vardaman. He's an atmospheric physicist, and so it's not my specialty. But I understand they are convinced that the ice age did occur. It definitely did occur, and it was caused by the flood. Any other questions? Yes. It says everything on dry land died. But to be honest with you, the marine mammals would have had to dive deep. I think many of them would have been killed. Many of the fish would have been killed. But there would have been enough to survive at the prodigious rate in which they reproduce to replenish the oceans. So that's something to consider because of the violent processes, but still, the Lord is at work. I mean, when you think about this, if we have processes that violent, how could the ark have even held together? A modern aircraft carrier made of steel, okay, welded together as strong as possible, would have been torn apart. So how could a wooden boat? Well, the answer is 8:1. God remembered Noah. He held it together. Okay, that's the answer, and that's not a cop out. That's just what it is. The only reason why Noah and those who were with him in the ark survived is because God remembered Noah. That's why. I think. Any other questions? We're at 5 after, and I understand that they can't play downstairs if I'm talking up here, so I don't want to keep them from playing downstairs. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for what we can learn from your word as we study it, dig into the text. Thank you for what I have learned, even about the 5 fixed dates and the areas of research that are before us in the FAST project. I pray, Lord, that the project will be able to continue we'll be able to be funded, and we'll be able to come up with some very significant results by 2011 in time for the 50th anniversary for Whitcomb and Morris's Genesis Flood. I pray, Lord, that Dr. Whitcomb would be able to survive to see that work, to see the fruits of his labor as it's been gone over and revised and improved, and our understanding of your word and the flood has been has been expanded, and where it needs to be corrected has been corrected. May we rightly divide the word of truth, even if it means to give up cherished theories of the past. May we rightly divide it, and we need your help to do that. We ask for your Holy Spirit to illuminate our hearts to that end. Continue to bless us, Lord, in this conference. We thank you for the wonderful camp we've had, and we just pray that you'll tonight, as we consider the building of the tabernacle, all that was involved in that, and we just pray that you'll bless your words to our hearts as we study together. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.